And he's a pretty good dunker. I mean, he pulled off some pretty great shit.
Yeah, and there's some, I guess there's some NBA players that you'd love to see do it that won't even do it. Like what, Ja Morant won't,
yeah, won't touch it won't, or anything. Zion said he doesn't think he will. And so that kind of makes sense that you have to go that deep. But like, I'm not even black and I feel like it was disrespectful.
Mm-hmm.
Like as a white person doing it, it's like, that's your guys' sport.
Do you think that was motivation? Like, listen, we want all you guys competing in this. So we're going to put some pressure on you.
Do you want to see this shit happen 2 years in a row? Yeah. No. I don't care if he's fucking 5'6" like Nate Robinson was, or he's 7 foot like Dwight Howard was. We got to figure out a solution to this.
What's the dude that plays for the Nuggets?
Jokic?
Yeah. He just stands under the hoop and just dunks it. And they're like, winner!
That's really all it is. The man's a two-time MVP. So, are you concerned about doing this sober? I get that you've been doing this sober for a while, but...
No, I don't think I have concern doing it. I think I would probably get, as weird as this sounds, like reading through, listening to stuff, watching stuff on it. I like that my attention is completely focused and everything. I feel like I'm a little more, I don't know if this is so much like a conversation to have like some fun with, like some of our other conversations. So I don't think it's going to really put a damper on it. I miss it. I miss it so much.
But yeah, sobriety is a fucking not fun.
Soon. Yeah. Soon
enough. Yeah. I just, with this, I mean, we're two white guys having a discussion about Black History Month.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have to figure out how to keep it light because it's very serious subject matter for us.
Oh yeah. I mean, and I have stuff that, and it's like, you know, I feel like I have to kind of state it because it helps set the stage, but there's going to be terminology and everything like here that are not my words.
No,
I'm reading direct quotes from documents, you know, things like that. But yeah, let's not, I guess, beat around the bush. So we are picked out a couple different topics for Black History Month to end the month. And these are things that, you know, traditionally we didn't, you know, we weren't going to cover Martin Luther King Jr. because I felt like that might have been just too on the nose, not to be disrespectful or anything like that. But we want to cover a couple different stories and he needs an entire episode just to himself. So I think we're going to kind of discuss more of things that people might know about, you know, kind of in a cursory type way. But it's going to kind of shine some light on maybe some, you know, unknowns or maybe people that haven't gotten their dues or aren't really, you know, don't have, I guess, a lot of the, what would you say, a lot of the.
Martin Luther King has a day. We talk about him. Yeah, even the whitest schools, as much as they want to try to fight it, we still have a little bit of talk about Martin Luther King.
It's not publicity. It's just, I guess, visual. It's just visually just. It's out there. People know about it. But again, we will go ahead and cover that. But we're going to go ahead and cover some stuff that's a little more. It's not even niche stuff, but it's.
We wheelhouse this. Wheelhouse mine, and I think you wheelhoused yours.
Yes, I actually think in that that's what I think is going to lead into this. So this is going to be also kind of a combination of what we've been doing a couple previous episodes where Adam went ahead and selected a couple different people. And then I went ahead and selected one that covers a lot of different people. And it's going to kind of give us a chance not only to educate everyone listening to this, but also to kind of educate each other and find out something maybe we didn't know.
And as far as I'm concerned, these are, we talk about patriotism so much. These are Black American patriots. These are people who I believe see this world and this country a lot different than when you hear the general term about being an American or being a patriot. Mm-hmm. These dudes had to fight to be Americans.
That's the whole thing is these people Americans. Like, and even in mind, these people are, at their core, they love a country that, frankly, at this time and the time that I'm going to discuss for my time frame, there's not a lot of love being thrown back at them.
No, it's a one-way street.
Mm-hmm.
Their desire to be Americans is far surpasses any desire that any of us have ever had, because as white people and as, you know, people that are looked at a little bit differently, we're born into being Americans. We're mm-hmm. born into Americana, the patriotism, all that kind of shit. These people were rejected by those same patriots, yet still continued to fight to be a part of it.
We almost feel like it's our birthright because we're born here, regardless of what we do with our time here, because we're born here. And I think a lot of these people have the mentality that although, you know, their ancestors were brought here against their will, you know, during the slave trade and everything like that, these are people that do have an understanding that their ancestors did contribute to building this country in an enormous way. And so in that sense, they take that upon themselves and say, we helped build this country. This is our country. We have just as much right to it as anybody else. And that's absolutely true.
And no matter how many times you tell us that we aren't a part of this country, we are still going to continue to fight for that spot.
You made us a part of this country.
Yeah. you brought us
so
here.
So fucking deal with it. And we're here to stay. So, yeah, if you want to go, do you want to knock? I think you're going to knock yours out first, right?
Yeah, sure. Okay. I said we went wheelhouses. I chose two kind of lesser known people who I think have had sort of an influence in this country, and it's something that, being like a food person, I can't use the word foodie because I hate foodies, but
food enthusiast.
You learn
cuisine enthusiast.
Yeah, a pro. I'm a I can't even think of the right word to use it. But there's so many things in life that we take for granted, and cuisine is one of them. What do you think about when you think about the most American shit out there? Like, what do you do on the 4th of July every year?
Hot dogs, hamburgers.
On the barbecue.
Yeah.
Barbecue's not American. Barbecue isn't something that was developed by a bunch of white guys that wanted to stand around a pit. Barbecuing was developed by and just Southern cuisine kind of in and of itself. There weren't white people cooking in those kitchens. That wasn't how it all worked.
Oh, no.
It was slaves that were slaving over those meals that were then served by other black people to white people.
I'm going to touch directly, and I know I see the dates on yours. Looking at the dates on yours, it even kind of like, I'm not saying this is a bummer topic for me and everything like that, because it does have, there are parts of it that are, a bummer's not even the word to say it, it's just really unfortunate, and quite frankly, it's kind of embarrassing as part of our history, the treatment of essentially an entire group of people that are here and want to contribute and want to make this their own. And, you know, your dates are back even in kind of I always forget. So when it's sometime in the 1700s, they call it the 18th century. Yep. Okay. So even in the 18th century, some of the stuff that you're talking about is still prevalent when I'm going to be talking about stuff in the 20th century.
The dates change, but the sentiment is still very similar, which is shocking that we have to go this far in order to say it. And I don't really want to look at this as far as like such a sad topic, because these two guys that I'm going to talk about were fucking studs.
Yeah.
They were great individuals, and the means as to what happened to them, not great, but it also kind of shed some light on understanding where our country came from.
Yeah.
So, first guy that we can talk about, and I'll talk a little bit more about the cuisine and stuff when I get to our second guy, but Hercules Posey. He was born in 1748 in Virginia, but not in Virginia, in the Virginia colonies.
Okay.
Because that's how far back this is still going.
Did that cover essentially what we know now as West Virginia and Virginia?
I think it was just strictly Virginia at this point. Because West Virginia is kind of more like Midwest-y.
Gotcha.
It's a little bit closer to like Ohio and in and around there. But he was acquired by our first president, George Washington, from a neighbor over a debt. The neighbor's name was John Posey. They had lived close to each other. I don't know if it was sort of like Washington gave him some pigs, some steer, or anything like that, but it was a debt that was owed that was paid by Posey giving George Washington slaves.
Was George Washington president at this time?
No, not yet.
Okay.
No. Oh, that gets even funner.
Okay.
So he had three, maybe four children, just kind of depending.
John Posey did.
Yeah.
Not Hercules. Okay.
It's a weird system to talk about because.
Oh, he took the last. Okay. There we go.
Yeah. So
you take the last. Well, fuck. That's. Yeah. Okay.
If you didn't know, it's not something that really gets publicized in history. Most African Americans' last names come from the slave ownership. sort of tree.
Jefferson, that they were Washington, from. That kind of.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. So when you see Justin Jefferson catch a ball, it wasn't that he came, or his descendants came from Thomas Jefferson. Of course
Jefferson's. Not. Jefferson isn't like an African or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, no. Okay. There's no Jeffersons in Africa.
Yeah. If you think about that, it makes perfect sense, but you never really think about, yeah.
Yeah. There were no Arenuses in Africa. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just not how it all goes. So when these things are listed back then, they were listed on basically like a census,
mm-hmm.
but they were broken down by the workers on the farm. Okay. Was basically how it was almost like not cattle, but sort of like cattle. Like I had 2 black people, 3 black people, some names, some not.
Numbers on a sheet.
Yeah. And he was actually one of two cooks that Washington always listed on the census. And he was actually a part of in 1790. This was something that I had forgotten about. Washington, D.C. wasn't always the capital of this country. And George Washington actually served his first presidency in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Which, kind of cool. Just a little refresher.
But it makes sense because that's where essentially, you know, our Declaration of Independence and everything like that was drafted. So I think that's where kind of the heart of the nation, or the heart of the early, you know, birth of the nation was.
It was. It just seemed like such an accident because Pennsylvania doesn't have a lot of ports to get into. So if you want to make that your capital, you'd think you'd want to kind of put it where Washington is now on the Potomac.
Well, in kind of contrast to that, but you want your capital to be defensible.
True. Yes,
so essentially, if you're sending in a letter being like, hey, Britain, fuck you, we're doing our own thing, you don't want the first place that the British are going to be able to land is going to be your capital.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. We didn't see it coming when the Canucks snuck down and burned it down mm-hmm. in D.C., but yeah.
You never suspect it from Canada.
No. The British were tricky that day, or the French, whoever talked
them. There's no one riding around going, the Canadians are coming, the Canadians are coming.
To bring us maple syrup? Mm-hmm. What are they doing? So John Posey was one of 9 slaves that was taken to Philadelphia. Hercules Posey, sorry. John Posey was the original slave owner. Hercules Posey was taken to the capital of the country in Philly, and he worked inside of the White House. The tricky thing about coming from Mount Vernon in Virginia, where they were from, was Philadelphia and Pennsylvania law said, I think this was a little bit later on, but if an African-American lived in Pennsylvania and established residency for longer than 6 months, they would be declared a free man, which is cool. I mean, they're in the North. Like, that's kind of something that should just happen. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't have to debate that or argue that. Washington, not a big fan of it. Washington privately said, I am a resident of Virginia. I was tasked to come to Philadelphia and live here in order to do my job. As a Virginian, I should be able to hold that kind of stuff.
I have some weird form of diplomatic immunity or whatever the fuck you want to call it.
Yep, I'm never going to be a member of Pennsylvania's, like, I'm not a Pennsylvanian or whatever the fuck they're calling them.
You want to be president, bitch? You're going to be a citizen of Pennsylvania.
So, in order to work around that, Washington's lawyer and him devised this plan where right around every 5 months, he would actually rotate the slaves back to Virginia so they wouldn't be able to establish citizenship. Which, it sounds like this is he's a slave. That's what it sounds mm-hmm. like.
And he's being kept a slave.
Uh-huh. But Hercules was given sort of a little bit of reins. He wasn't given enough of what he deserved. But Martha would actually allow him to sell the scraps out of the kitchen after meals mm-hmm. to people on the street. So he was able to make money for himself. And he made kind of right around what an actual cook would make, between $100 to $200 a year, which doesn't sound like shit. But we're talking about 1790.
Yeah.
So decent money. Hercules was a man about town. Like, he was fairly known around Philadelphia to dress nice, to look nice. He would go out after shifts at the White House, which I don't understand how you would. Maybe he just felt that his situation had improved so much from Mount Vernon mm-hmm. that he was in a decent position.
Well, I mean, if you're in Philadelphia and they already had this rule in place 6 months, you'd be declared a free man. There were probably a lot of, or not, I don't know the number, what I would consider a lot, but there were probably more essentially free men there. And there was probably more of a, it wasn't something like they just saw, you know, some black guy walking alone in Virginia. They'd be like, where the fuck are you going?
True.
In Philadelphia, it was probably more so like, okay, you've been here for 6 months. There's of course still, you know, discrimination, all that kind of stuff, but people were probably a lot more accustomed to it. Not the discrimination, but seeing people just walk, you know, freely around.
Yeah. If you had 50 eyes looking at you the mm-hmm. first time when you're in Philadelphia, maybe 25 that.
Yeah.
So I love the fact that he just always dressed nice. Like, he made his money. He didn't want to look the part of a slave, mm-hmm. so he dressed. I think they kept calling him like a dandy, which sounds like a very funny term to mm-hmm. think about now. But a dandy carries the same connotation now as it did back then. There's very few words that don't go through that revolution. Yeah.
When you dress for the Kentucky Derby, you're dressing like a dandy.
Mm-hmm. Every time. Frilly shirt.
You got that little, I don't know what the ascot, that like yep. little puffy thing. You got the frills and
cummerbund, mm-hmm. dickie, just whatever goofy shit.
You got
shit
some heels on your, you got some heels on your boots. Big old fucking buckles.
So Martha allowing him to sell the extra scraps and kind of feed other people sort of probably gave him enough independence to where he didn't feel like he needed to try to escape or run away. His younger son that actually came to DC or came to Philadelphia with him, helped him in the kitchen. While he was sent back to Mount Vernon, there were some questions about maybe a theft that Hercules' son was a part of. Washington got a little bit concerned that maybe he was giving Hercules a little too much leeway. Mm. And so he kind of started to crack down on him. Hercules thought, well, you and I kind of had an understanding. I was getting paid. I was able to go around town. Now you're going to put the clamps on me because you think I'm going to run away. I'm probably going to take off now.
So yeah, this isn't getting better. You start making things worse. I'm used to being out and about.
Yeah.
You're not taking that shit away.
We've taken some steps forward in our relationship. Now you're trying to rein mm-hmm. them back in. I'm an adult. I'm a man. I'm not a child.
You're skirting the law, even by sending me back every few months,
uh-huh.
just to go ahead and keep me in this position. Technically, I shouldn't even have to be leaving. I should have been, within the first 6 months here, I should have been a free man. Then we could have maybe negotiated something where if you needed my services, I would have made those available.
Yeah. Hey, treat me like a human being. And we're going to see that with James Hemmings coming up. But it's not so much about the freedom aspect of it. It's just to be treated equally. And I'm assuming that that's sort of where Hercules started to crack the plan to try to leave. Because there was kind of some questions about it within the past 40, 50 years as to how he actually escaped. Things have kind of been clamped down a little bit better. Some people thought he escaped from Philadelphia. He actually was brought back to Mount Vernon. And on, what was it, February 22nd, 1797, it was Washington's 65th birthday. They went to look for Hercules in the kitchen.
That's got
to
be old as fuck at that point.
Yeah.
Back then, 65.
You don't live that long unless you're a person of means.
Yes.
And even in Washington's perspective, 65, with as many battles and shit as he had mm-hmm. seen, 65, excuse me, he had to be one of the oldest living soldiers at that point.
Oh, yeah.
So, going to the kitchen, I'm sure, to look for Hercules. Apparently, George Washington was a real big pancake guy. Hmm. Big pancake guy. Hercules talked a lot about how he would always start his mornings in the White House kitchen cooking pancakes. So they go into the kitchen looking for Hercules, I'm sure looking for George's actual cake.
Mm-hmm.
Probably said, happy 65th, Georgie, we heart you.
Can't Hercules, believe he's still alive.
Yeah, Hercules nowhere to be found. They figured out that he hadn't been seen for actually the last 4 days on the Mount Vernon plantation, compound, whatever it was. So he had a 4 day head start.
So this was after Washington was already done being president.
Yep.
He moved back to Mount Vernon at the time. Okay.
So he had actually escaped from Mount Vernon back to Philadelphia. From Philadelphia, he went to New York. There's been kind of more clearance on how he actually finished off his life. I don't like that. It doesn't jive with me the way that Hercules was such a badass. 1799 is when George Washington died. So a little ways after that. And George Washington put it in his will that all his slaves were to be freed at that point in 1800. Oh,
how generous.
Yeah, pretty cool. I'm dead. You guys can go off and live your own lives. So
I realized I could have just been paying you guys this whole time and you guys could have been free and a lot of you would have hung out because you were getting paid and had a decent life. But once I'm gone, fuck it.
Have at it. I was the most important white guy in this country. I could have set a precedent for every mm-hmm. other white guy. I'm going to wait till I'm dead before yeah. that happened. So Martha, I think right around this time, was like, okay, that was probably a good idea. Instead of inheriting the slaves that I could get when my husband George died,
mm-hmm.
I'm just going to let him go free. At that point, didn't really matter for Herc. Herc was out of there. He may have been up in New York around that time. And there are sort of more evidence, there is more evidence that he passed away May 15th, 1812 in New York. There's The thing that I question about it, and the thing that I want to believe, so I'm just going to throw it out there because that might be concrete. There is a painting of a black man in this place called the Thyssen Bornija in Spain. It's a big art gallery. Mm-hmm. It's a black dude in chef's whites that bore a very striking resemblance to all the other paintings. And there's not a lot of other paintings of Hercules, mm-hmm. but looked very, very close.
Well, here's the thing, too, is what kind of records are they keeping at this point for freemen at that point if someone passes away? The other thing that may lead a little bit of kind of credence to that, him not dying at that time, is if Hercules is essentially at that point an escaped slave on the run, making it back to Philly, New York, what's the chances he's going to keep going by the same name? Just in case, back in Philly, Washington puts out some feelers, is like, has anyone heard of this guy, you know, Hercules Posey? All he has to do is change his name.
And it's not out of the realm of possibility, because there were slave chasers that would chase black people into free states mm-hmm. to try to bring them back. There were laws that later sort of tried to outlaw it, but were then shot down, saying that it was okay to do it because technically they were still their property. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if he would have kept his name. I mean, Hercules probably wasn't the most common name back then. Badass name.
Oh, yeah.
But they've come to disprove that the painting is actually supposed to be of a freed, I think it was a Dominican man that was cooking over in Spain. But I got to believe that it was him, because it's just the best way to end that story.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that he escaped slavery, he went to Philly, he went to New York, then he crossed the sea and was over in Spain cooking in kitchens over there.
It's is it Red Skelton? And Andy Dufresne from Shawshank.
Yeah,
it's that kind of situation where he gets over there. He ends up it's not in Zihuatanejo. At this point, it's somewhere in Spain where he gets to live out the rest of his life.
Well, and I'm assuming back then, too. I don't know where Spain was as far as the slave trade. I'm sure they probably dabbled in it, too, more than most. But to see a picture of a black man in a chef's whites hung up in an actual art museum, it's pretty cool. Like, that's a very far off, distant land from where that man came from, wherever it was. And I hope that it is Hercules. I hope that history was wrong about it. So Hercules is my first guy. Just a fun dude. He didn't. None of these guys ever deserved what they were born into. No slaves ever deserved what they were born into. But the fact that he was able to escape and to make something of his life, for if it only was 12 years or 15 years after he escaped.
Mm-hmm.
But he was able to at least taste that freedom. And he was also a great chef. Like, he would serve anybody that came to the White House. So he was serving anybody that was coming over from different countries.
Yeah, like foreign dignitaries. Anybody like that are guests of honor being served by this guy. Or, you know, and I don't mean like served in that sense, but this guy is responsible for essentially, you know, if you go somewhere and the food sucks, that's going to make the experience, like, he was obviously very good at his job.
Well, the fun part about GW was most other places, the slaves would be the ones that would serve too. So there would be black people serving white people.
Mm-hmm.
In Philadelphia, he decided to try to keep up better appearances and actually hired white wait staff to go in and serve the people. So he didn't want to keep portraying that he was a slave man from the South that had all black help. So he had white people serving a black man's food under the guise that this was going to be Martha's recipe. Everything was always the woman's recipe.
Mm-hmm.
And getting into James Hemmings, my second guy,
probably tasting Martha's food, and he's like, this stuff is flavorless as shit, and just amps it up and then serves it. And she's like, I don't remember tasting like this. I don't remember me being this good, but goddamn, this is tasty.
What's happening in my mouth? What is that? Is that some sort of, is that
this
salt?
Does not taste like boiled goose or boiled whatever the fuck they were making at that time.
Yeah, if it doesn't taste like boiled water, it definitely didn't come from a white person at that point. So James Hemmings, I would consider him a founding father of this country in a culinary sense. He just, for being a slave in the way that he was under Jefferson, his story's awesome. And Jefferson is a very odd fellow, just kind of top to bottom. James was born in 1765 in Charles City County, Virginia, another Virginian. His parents were Betty Hemmings and a gentleman named John Wales. Now, John Wales, not a slave. John Wales, very white man. John Wales, also the father of Thomas Jefferson's wife, Martha Jefferson. So John or James Hemings and Thomas Jefferson were brother-in-laws, technically.
Hmm. Was Jefferson also the one that's notorious for sleeping with the slaves?
I'm glad that you asked that, because James Hemings' youngest sister, Sally Hemings, actually had 6 children that were fathered by Thomas Jefferson. So, TJ had a nice little intermingling with his slave staff.
Mm-hmm.
He liked the dark meat, apparently.
I was going to say Jefferson. Ding! New kink unlocked.
No, he definitely was a man about town, so to speak. But James grew up, he was obviously acquired under Thomas Jefferson because John Wales died. He left his slaves and all of his holdings to Martha. Martha married Thomas, so Thomas became the slave owner of all of Martha's slaves as well. So that is how James Hemings becomes under Thomas Jefferson. But
despite being his brother-in-law.
A slave brother-in-law. Mm-hmm. His brother-in-law was his slave. I think that Thomas Jefferson, obviously by his proclivity to bang his slaves, had a little bit different outlook on black people, but not enough to be a better person about it.
No, I feel like he probably thought that they, well, of course, like he thinks that they're property. He can just do whatever he wants with them. I don't think Jefferson was probably really involved in these children's lives.
No, and Jefferson pulls some shit kind of towards the end of James Hemings' life that isn't. It kind of sort of lays out his feelings about black people in general. But Jefferson took James to France in 1784 at the age of 19. And Jefferson was like the minister to the court of Versailles or something like that over there. So yep. It was like an American diplomatic position that mm-hmm. he held in France. And he took James over there primarily because he'd fallen in love with French culture so much that he actually wanted to eat French food back in America.
Yeah, I think he was like the ambassador to France for like the early America or the early United States. So he was over there for a while. And of course, like you have basically what's a developing country in the United States that is probably pretty bare bones about, you know, culture and like culinary skills. Then you have France, which is, you know, almost still to this day between France and Italy, just a complete, you know, hub of culinary culture.
Yeah. And their French and Italian roots are in so much. I think we talked about it a little earlier, like a few episodes ago, maybe not even an episode, but tomatoes, not mm-hmm. French.
Hmm.
Tomatoes are South American that were brought over there, and those vines that were brought from South America to Italy, or I think I said not French before, but tomatoes weren't Italian. So all the Italian dishes, pomodoros, anything like that pizza. That has tomatoes in Italy.
Spaghetti, anything with a marinara?
Yeah.
Or tomato-based sauce, or any of that shit.
Traditional Italian is usually pescatarian. It's very fish-heavy,
mm-hmm.
and it's
more usually, like what you would think of a Mediterranean diet.
Yep. Like a white sauce, a clear mm-hmm. olive oil, all that kind of stuff is Italian. Tomatoes were an import that was brought in and then grown and then just taken over by Italy. But getting back to France, James Hemings not only was the first black chef to ever be classically trained in French cooking, he was the first American chef to ever be trained classically. And when I say classically, cuisine in France, it's not like here. Like, you go to a CIA, you go to a culinary institute.
I've seen Ratatouille. I know what's up. No, but even the French system of cooking. You know, if you think about stuff here, like, and you look in the back of a kitchen at a restaurant, and I think some, you know, because the French style is where everyone kind of has a thing that they do. You have the person that's in charge of sauces. This person is in charge of all of the bread type stuff. This person would be in charge of, you know,
cold apps, warm apps.
Mm-hmm.
There's somebody on the grill, and it's a brigade style. It's very tough to learn. Hemings was getting a small wage while over there training. And I think part of it was from Jefferson just to kind of keep up appearances because, again, we're going to a country where free men are free men.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no slavery technically in France. So all James had to do was declare himself a free man over there and he wasn't going back.
Yeah.
So all this time that he was over there, he knew that he was a slave and he knew that he could get out. Sally also went over there, shockingly enough, to France as a helper to one of Thomas Jefferson's younger children. Mm. I think she was like 12. I don't think Sally was that much younger.
In the or au pair.
Yeah.
She was the nanny or the au pair.
Pretty much. And I'm sure banging the nanny and au pair the whole time. So we're not going to get into the weird child sex of that, but just know that Sally Hemings played a very huge role in Thomas Jefferson's life. But while he was over there, he became a chef de cuisine, which over here we're called a master chef, within 3 to 5 years of training. So he was able, there's French chefs that will study for 10 to 12 years to get the title of chef de cuisine. But James was so good in the kitchen that he was able to learn French while he was being taught in French kitchens. And he was able to pick up and be such a wunderkind of cooking that he became a chef de cuisine in 3 to 5 years. That, as a food guy, that blows my mind to think that you can be classically trained in the French style that fast and pick up on it. And still be, like, looked at. There's a guy named Jacques Pepin. He teaches, like, master classes and shit. Very famous French chef. Mm-hmm. Looks at James very fondly because it took him that much long. It took him, he said that he's still trying to master the French art of cookery, and James considered a chef de cuisine that fast. Just an all-out stud.
A prodigy.
Huh?
Like, almost like a prodigy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like he found his niche in life, and he just crushed it. So, in 1789, they returned to America, and like I say, the weirdest thing, this is where he becomes, to me, an American patriot. Because he could have told Thomas Jefferson to fuck off. He could have walked into a French, I guess, parliament, wherever, at any time, and said, hey, did you guys know that me and my sister here are slaves, and that Thomas Jefferson brought us over here as slaves, and tried to pay us, but technically he's going to take us back and we're going to be slaves, and just completely ruin French and American, like, friendships.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't. He decided to come back to America with Thomas Jefferson. TJ knew at this point that he was going to have to continue to pay him because their relationship had changed.
He's
quite a
goddamn
bit.
Master chef.
Yep. And he was brought kind of on tour. It was him and I think one of the tailors. Some of the earlier people that signed the Declaration of Independence kind of went on a little tour. And he would actually let James go ahead and, like, scout locations and buy food. So when they showed up, he would have meals ready and prepared for them. He actually in, what was it? It was
1795.
Well, yeah, before that. So 1793, he basically told Jefferson, yo, I'm not going to do this my whole entire life. You and I need to have a talk. We need to sign a contract. I want to be a free man. Jefferson, in his infinite love of being a deal maker, wrote out a contract that James would be freed on the contingency that they would go back to Monticello, whatever it is, and that James would actually train his younger brother in the same ways that James was trained to be able to cook for him. So James' route to freedom was to train his younger brother to continue to cook for Thomas Jefferson, and that was how he was going to win his freedom, with caveat of his little brother still being the slave cook for Thomas Jefferson.
At the same, and I'm not saying that, you know, this was his mindset and everything like that, but I can definitely see it as a way of saying, okay, if this is getting me out of that, if I can teach my little brother to do this, then he has that same bargaining chip.
Yeah, will there be another step that he takes?
Yeah, can he then use that essentially to say, okay, at this point, I've now been your cook for 5 years. I want that same contract. You let me go and I'll teach the next guy in line.
Yeah, and just kind
give me a fucking white guy that I can teach.
And that could be it. Was he saw that it could potentially be a route to freedom for his family and for other slaves that were still on the plantation of Monticello. So, 1795, he's still working for Jefferson because he is being technically paid a wage, so you would call it working, I guess. He cooked a dinner in 1795 for the U.S. leaders and all the French diplomats that came over. And it was the dinner that they decided the reconciliation for all the debt that the U.S. had accrued during the Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm.
This was also the same dinner where they decided where the U.S. Capitol was going to be placed, on the Potomac in Washington, D.C. So moving forward, they were going to be moving out of Philadelphia. I guess there was like a plague or something that had hit Philadelphia.
Hmm.
And so they knew that they kind of had to get out of there.
Yeah.
And
it's a little more centrally located. I'm sure at this point the country is kind of, you know, expanded from the northern area where most people were. And I guess choosing Washington, D.C. also made it more, I guess, centralized in that situation where it would be...
You're close to Virginia, you're close to Maryland. Yeah,
not quite an equal distance between the North and the South, but you're at least, it's, you know, you're giving them a token. Let's go ahead and put this, and this will be the capital for everybody.
And during this dinner, he had actually prepared something that nobody in America had ever seen before. This, in order to really kind of appreciate this as much as I do, you have to realize at this point in time in 1795, refrigerators weren't a thing. There was no real cooling system besides like blocks of ice and that kind of thing. James Hemings figured out a way to cook a cake in a cast iron pan, and he actually wrapped solid ice cream inside of a meringue, like you would see in a baked Alaska, put that in there. Cooked everything all together, so when they cut it open out at the table, the ice cream was still in a solid form over the cake. So he was able to figure out how to insulate ice cream inside of a meringue, which holds in a lot of whatever is holding it in. So it was like an insulation layer of meringue over this cake that was then cooked in a cast iron skillet over a fire in order to cook the cake. So
I don't even understand that now. Like what you're just saying to me, I'm just like, it's heat. And if you're having to cook something long enough for the cake to settle or for the cake to rise or do whatever, you would think that, and I know they do deep fried ice cream now, but deep fried ice cream, they're like putting it in the deep fryer for literally like seconds.
It would take enough of insulation qualities of that meringue to be able to hold the cold in for the ice
cream. But to know how to do that.
Yeah. It's that kind of savviness that he had in the kitchen and those kind of things that he brought over. We'll get into some of the stuff that he brought in, but as far as like modern cuisines go, Thomas Jefferson knew the best way to get out and gain support would be to have these large feasts in areas where there are constituents that he would gain followings from by doing barbecues outside. He would have slaves tending pits. You've heard of whole hog barbecue. That is strictly an African-American thing that the slaves would be living, growing, raising these pigs and these farm animals, slaughtering them, then cooking them or preparing them overnight over a pit of coals. You have to know exactly where to put the coals underneath the thicker parts of the pig so it all cooks at the same time. It's just a very technological way of doing things. So when you think of like modern day barbecue, that all has very African American roots. And when you think about Southern cuisine just as a whole, grits, not really an American thing. It was African Americans that were trying to feed their children that knew that they could serve them to white people in order for them to get sustenance. One of Thomas Jefferson's favorite birds, guinea fowl, not American, came from Africa. That was an African bird that was brought over. So just the way that he created a culinary kind of like a lane, I think it's called haute cooking. I'm not great on the pronunciation of it. I've seen it a lot, but Hemings actually like created basically Southern cuisine, just with the way that he would prepare things. And not only Hemings, because there's a lot of African-American cooks, but in all these Southern kitchens down there, all that cooking was done by slaves.
Yeah.
So when you see, Thomas Jefferson takes a lot of credit for a lot of stuff that Hemings did. And it's something as simple as mac and cheese was introduced to America by James Hemings. He introduced pasta in a cheese sauce, which he called macaroni pie, which came from France because they were obviously doing things with pasta dressed in sauce before. Macaroni and cheese is one of the most American dishes I can think of, not American starting.
If you can make it in a fucking microwave and mix in a powder and it can become mac and cheese.
Yeah, we're creating powdered mac and cheese now where you can throw it in the microwave, like you say, for 3 minutes with a little bit of milk and some pasta and it's all cooked in. French fries. Also something that was introduced by James Hemings to the United States.
Papa frites? What do you call them in Paris?
Pommes frites. Yep. Brought over to America. Ice cream, like I said earlier. You're dealing with a kitchen that doesn't have any way to freeze anything. That's the other thing, too, that kind of gets lost in this time, is in order to create a feast for 20 or 30 people, you can't kill those chickens days before.
No.
Those chickens have to be killed like the night before, then plucked, then cleaned, then you start cooking them immediately before that meat goes bad in order for that kind of sustenance to be given to people fresh. Because there was no way to store them
No, that meat's not getting any cooler.
No.
It's going to drop a little bit from body temperature, but then it's just going to get to room temperature, and that's where fucking bacteria is just going to go fucking crazy.
Exactly. So you treated these people subhuman, but you also put, like, the most important part of your life as far as eating and getting nutrition into their hands.
Well, fuck, can you imagine the pressure, though, on these people to make sure, you know, on these cooks and everything like that, to get it right? Because what's going to happen if you give a fucking party, like, of dignitaries or, you know, people that are prominence, or even just, you know, Jefferson, food poisoning?
You're dead.
Yeah.
Or your family's dead.
Mm-hmm.
Something of that ilk.
Because they're going to be like, you tried to poison me. They're not going to be like, this was just, no, let me explain to you. You guys killed the chickens too early, and then you tried to make me cook with that, and so it was the bacteria and everything like that. They're going to be like, no, you tried to fucking poison me.
And that's, every meal is almost like a life or death situation for you.
It's not just like, this didn't taste as good as the last one. You know, I'm going to fucking kill you. It's, you know, it literally is a matter of like, I got to make sure I'm getting this shit, exactly correct. Not only does it have to taste good, it has to be completely safe.
Yeah. You have to impress these people with the taste, but you also have to make sure that they don't spend the next 3 days on the chamber pot.
Yeah.
He also brought whipped cream to America, and prior to the invention of a mixer or anything like that, it's done in a bowl with egg whites in a whisk by hand.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to sit there and spin those egg whites as fast as you can. Just
keep folding it to get the air in there to go ahead and get it whipped.
With arm strength in order to create whipped cream. Also brought creme brulees over here. So the nice creamy dish that's sprinkled with sugar on top and then creme brulee on top, so you get the beautiful crack in there. He brought all these French culinary inventions over to America and introduced a bunch of savage white people that didn't really have a whole lot beyond just throw everything in a pot and cook it and hope that it turns out well. He introduced fine dining. Instead of
just eating fucking stew?
Mm-hmm.
What's in this stew? It's best you don't ask what's in the stew.
Yeah, that's...
whatever we could find.
If you think hot dogs are gross, imagine that being in a stew every single night and not knowing what you're eating. But he introduced fine dining to this country. He cooked for diplomats all over the place, just everywhere. And once he was finally freed in 1796... he went back to Philadelphia. He ends up in Baltimore. But when he's back in Philadelphia working, he actually gets a letter from one of Thomas Jefferson's aides requesting his presence to be the White House cook, the specific cook for Thomas Jefferson when he became president. He turned him down. He said, if TJ wants me to come back and be his White House cook, I'm going to need him to go ahead and write me a letter by hand requesting my presence being there by himself, man to man. Thomas Jefferson refused to do that for him. He refused to handwrite James Hemings a letter to have him come back and be that. There was some interaction between them. He'd come back to Monticello and cook for him a couple more times, but he never was back in an official capacity. In 1891, he ends up in Baltimore. He's cooking in just kind of a little pub in Baltimore, and there's so many kind of weird stories, because when Hercules passed away, supposedly he passed away of consumption, so he drank himself to death. James Hemings was reported as committing suicide by gunshot wound. Tough time believing that a black man in Baltimore committed suicide, as opposed to maybe him being a free black man in a society who still hasn't accepted it.
Looking at someone and they deem it disrespectful or something like that. Yeah.
So his ending wasn't great, but this man traveled the world and fed, I mean, our founding fathers. That's why I consider him a patriot and a founding father, because he brought the culinary influence from France and gave an identity to an entire whole section of the country.
Mac and cheese, French fries, ice cream, whipped cream. Like, I'm not saying you eat those things on a weekly basis, but those are staples.
It's an American. It's Americana.
What do you get with a fucking hamburger? Every fast food restaurant, French fries.
Yep. It's something that still lives on to this day, and he just doesn't get enough credit. Black cooks in general will never ever get the credit they deserve for creating the delicacies that we eat. And America is such a cultural melting pot that you see fried cheese curds, you see different things that are brought over from different parts of the country in a cultural way, and we celebrate them. Mm-hmm. You celebrate another thing coming up on St. Patrick's Day, corned beef and hash. Not something that they eat back in Ireland. It's a bastardized version that they
created. Beef and cabbage?
Corned beef and cabbage, corned beef and hash. You go back to Ireland, they do eat it, but it's not like the dish of Ireland.
It's like you guys chose this to fucking represent. Well, first of all, St. Patrick's Day is not even, is it even celebrated in Ireland, or is that bastardized version?
It's like Cinco de Mayo in Mexico.
It's a bastardized version of a, I'm sure, one of their well-known holidays or like cultural holidays. And we were just like, well, we don't have a day to get shit-faced this month in March. So let's just celebrate the Irish, I guess. Who likes to drink? The Irish? All right.
We have February covered because we're going to throw Mardi Gras in February. So we have a traditional French holiday mm-hmm. that comes from the South that we can get shit-faced on in February.
I didn't know Mardi Gras was French.
Huh?
I didn't know Mardi Gras was French.
Really?
No.
That's why it's always celebrated in the French Quarter of...
No, I know it is, but okay, that makes sense because that's why, yeah, New Orleans is so heavily French influence, yeah.
Well, there's just so many things that we celebrate from so many other countries, and it doesn't get enough credit that Southern cuisine kind of in general was created from Africans that came over to this country that sort of were able to feed their family with such meager rations, but then were also creating dishes in order to feed plantation owners and mm-hmm. all their friends at these galas and these beautiful things and barbecues that all came from a completely different country that never gets a shine. I mean, when you think about barbecue, you don't think about black people.
No.
When you think about cooking in general, you think about like...
But if you were to stop and think about it for a second, you would say, okay, you know, it's necessity and how and what you have available as far as your resources. Of course, it's going to make more sense that it, you know, it was invented in Africa. It's a situation in which, you know, they're not going to build something, you know, maybe smokehouses or something. That was Germany, I think, is where they started smoking stuff because...
Germany, kind of Sweden, yeah, around that area.
But then you have a situation where, okay, this is what we need. We need to be able to dig a hole in the ground. We need to be able to make a fire, and we need to be able to cook an animal. That requires almost no resources other than the animal and the tools to make the fire and the supplies. So, of course, when you don't have a lot of supplies, you're going to make do with what you have, and then you're going to not only figure out how to do that, but then you're going to start putting flourishes on it, and you're going to start making it better and better and better. And so when you do have additional resources, you're not going to go to something else. You're going to take what you know, and you're just going to go ahead and advance it.
And master it to make it as good as it can be. It's, like I say, it just gets lost so much in thinking about it just with every single thing. You can name pretty much any dish in Southern cooking to where it all kind of traces back to the way that it is. And seeing it now, when you think of like famous celebrity chefs that are white dudes,
mm-hmm.
it's great. But prior to the rise of the male celebrity chef, it was females that were in the kitchen mm-hmm. cooking. And so much of the, like the domestic stuff that you see, it's like when you think about women cooking and cleaning, before women were pushed into those cooking and cleaning roles.
Who was doing it?
Yeah, who had those roles before. Mm-hmm. So it's like the hierarchy was like slaves, then women, then men that start doing mm-hmm. it get to take the glory in the kitchen. Whereas its foundings, it was built upon slavery. Then it was passed on to women because we couldn't have slaves anymore. Mm-hmm. And then women were kind of like indentured servants that would do the cooking. And then the people that get the glory for it are all the dudes. So a little bit of feminist turnings in there. Mm-hmm. But as far as James Hemings goes, I mean, the guy can't be celebrated enough. Black cooks can't be celebrated enough. They brought so much culture to this country that we just don't recognize enough.
Yeah.
So that was my portion of it. Obviously, it was probably going to be food.
That's the thing, though, is like when you talk about something like that because you're passionate about it, it's a lot easier to get invested in this and to also understand how impressive it is. If you don't have a knowledge of what it takes to introduce all of this stuff and to have the knowledge, like we were talking about with the meringue wrapped around the ice cream, like that's not just he thought that up on his own or he thought that up one day and he's like, I'm going to try this. No, that was trial and error mm-hmm. and how much work went into trying to figure out to get that perfect enough to serve a fucking sitting president or, you know, all of these dignitaries. It was just simply him dedicating himself to this craft, not only being a master chef, but then also being able to, like, how much influence comes off of all of this stuff?
Well, and when you think about it, some of your best memories are usually wrapped up around a great meal that mm-hmm. you've had. it was a great dinner that you had where you had great times, where there was the wine was flowing, you were sitting around having a great time, and all that can be wrapped around something as intimate as a meal with six people at a table that was hand prepared. I struggle to kind of find the words to explain. Like, it's a form of love. To cook for somebody is kind of a form of
love. All right, let's take a quick bathroom break, and then we'll get back at it.
Deal.
All right, while we take a break from class and take care of some business, you can also take care of some business.
If you don't follow us on Instagram or Twitter already, our Instagram handle is historicallyhighpod. That's historicallyhigh, P-O-D. And our Twitter is historicallyhigh. That's historicallyhi.
All right, and back to our show. All right, and we are back. All right, so for my portion, you went with your lane. Everyone who's listened to this podcast before knows I have a certain war boner for World War II related topics. This one is, I had known about it. I had some knowledge about it, but diving deeper into this topic really drove home just how incredible the story of the Tuskegee Airmen is. And not only what they went through to be able to serve, you know, in World War II as pilots, but also what they had overcome even just to get to that point back home. It's one of those things where, you know, America comes into World War II and we're supposed to be, you know, the protector, the one that's going to help turn the tide of this thing. But we, and, you know, looking at the Nazis and everything, and I'm not comparing the two, but, you know, their persecution of, you know, the Jewish people or minorities or pretty much anybody they deemed inferior. It's pretty ironic that we were doing the same kind of shit, not in a sense of like murdering and gathering in concentration camps, but we also had this thing going on back home where we had this entire, you know, race of Americans that were somehow deemed inferior without any type of cause.
And we're considered kind of test subjects.
Yeah. So
were the Tuskegee experiments done on the Tuskegee Airmen too?
No. So this whole thing, the Tuskegee Airmen, was initially called the Tuskegee Experiment, but it wasn't that Tuskegee Experiment that a lot of people go through. The reason they called it the Tuskegee Experiment is because they expected it to fail. In a way, it was actually kind of designed to fail, which is even more impressive when you know, see how successful it's going to become. Overall, the Tuskegee Airmen, it kind of covers, and it's an umbrella term that not only covers the pilots themselves, but also everybody that participated essentially in the Tuskegee program. It wasn't just, you know, black pilots. Overall, there were about 16,000 between pilots and support personnel within the Tuskegee experiment. Now, this was also like all black ground crews, adjutants, all of the people that were in support of essentially this unit or formation of this were all black. Now, when it first started, they would have to have essentially white commanding officers because no one had reached that level of, you know, prominence within the United States military.
Yeah, they weren't given the ability to obtain the rank, so they weren't able to.
Yeah, and I mean, there were certain kind of outliers. This guy named Benjamin O. Davis Sr., his son is going to play a huge role in this. I mean, Benjamin O. Davis Sr. plays a huge role because he, in 1940, becomes the first black general. Wow. And he went to West Point. And,
really?
Yeah. So basically, FDR, it was after his, I think it was during his first term, he's already starting to kind of try to think about re-election. This is pre-World War II, so America hasn't entered into the fray yet. Pearl Harbor hasn't happened. Europe is at war at this point. America kind of sees the writing on the wall. FDR sees the writing on the wall and knows that at some point we're probably going to be into this, so let's go ahead and get a jump on it. So he made a promise that if he was reelected to his second term, he would create basically a black air program and allow those people that had been denied entry into certain like civilian pilot training programs would have their shot at this. And instead of creating, you didn't have an Air Force at this time, as we know it today, where there's a separate branch of the military, you have the Army, the Air Force, all that kind of stuff, the Navy. Basically, it was the Army Air Force. It was just the air branch of the Army at that point. And so FDR basically creates this civilian government civilian pilot training program. Now, this was created throughout the whole country. This was basically a way to, without getting people enlisted or people signing up for college graduate. I don't know if you had to be a college graduate. I think it was kind of one of the requirements, but college graduate males were able to start training in civilian, you know, civilian aircraft training. Basically, the rationale behind that was that let's train them to be pilots. That way, if we have to then train them to be fighter pilots, the transition is going to be that much easier. We're not training them how, you know, from square one, how to fly. They already know how to fly. So then we're just going to teach them air combat. And it's going to be a smooth transition. And we're going to be able to have, you know, basically an Air Force ready to go.
Well, and if you are requiring a college degree, you're sort of
excluding a lot of,
yes.
Yeah, you're already kind of doing that. Well, at this point, the Tuskegee Institute, what it was called, it was basically the Tuskegee College. Mm-hmm. They were awarded a government civilian pilot training program themselves. And Tuskegee president, and also think about the Tuskegee Institute, founded by Booker T. Washington.
Great man himself.
Mm-hmm. So the Tuskegee president, his name was Dr. Frederick Patterson. He lobbied the government to set up the base training for this black pilot training program at Tuskegee. And so...
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, but Tuskegee University is still around.
Yeah, it's in Tuskegee, Alabama.
No way.
So it's weird when you hear Tuskegee because you don't know really what it applies to. It's not only the town, but it's also, you know, the college, university, institute. And then this is, you know, where they get their name from. And then you had Tuskegee, I think, airfield or Tuskegee military base. So it was all kind of included in there. They were first trained at this place called Moton Field. And that was where they kind of got their flight school done. It wasn't the combat training or anything like that. Like, we're just going to teach you how to fly planes.
Just a little bit more of the private citizen type.
Exactly. It was their version of that. And then they would be moved over to Tuskegee Army Airfield for advanced training and then their combat, you know, combat training. So basically fighting, you know, they were having to fight this whole time against this. And this wasn't all they were fighting against because, of course, there's all this segregation, discrimination, all that shit. But in 1925, there used to be a thing called the War College. I don't know what that fucking entailed, but they would come out with studies. And 1925 War College study stated, and I quote, that they were mentally inferior and their weakness of character were factors in determining if black soldiers could participate in certain aspects of warfare. They were just fine. And this was horse shit because I'm going to give you some examples, but this kind of applied to technical tasks, not labor-related roles, of course. So, of course, you could still be infantrymen and you could still be on the front lines, but when it came to technical-related tasks, which, you know, piloting tanks, aircraft, things like that, they figured that they didn't have the mental capacity to go ahead and do it.
Yeah, it's not like a ha-ha funny thing. It's just the ignorance is just sort of amusing to me. And I think we talked about it in Pearl Harbor when we were talking about that guy that was the...
He was the cook to the captain of the ship. It was, fuck, I can't remember his name. But he was the guy that manned the anti-aircraft gun.
Yeah, with no arms training because they weren't allowed to train them with weaponry.
Well, here's the thing. In World War I, there's a little bit of debate on this, but it's so close to this, it's fucking ridiculous. Almost 100% of cooks and stewards were black.
Huh. Interesting.
Mm. So that whole study was bullshit because they had so many examples of black soldiers being able to conduct themselves within the armed services to actually stand out even so much. There was a group in World War I called, it was the 369th Infantry, and their nickname, and I don't know if they got this from the French because they were assigned to French commanders. Okay. They're like, hey, we're going to get you guys some soldiers. And then they just pushed them off to the French commanders. But they were called the Harlem Hellfighters.
Huh.
And they spent more time on the front line than any other unit in the war. They were the first American unit to receive the Croix de Guerre. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. Again, it's French. We're not great at French here. But it was basically a version of the Medal of Valor. And it was a unit citation that they had received.
They're probably put mostly on the front lines too, because if they were lost during war,
I don't know if it was a fodder thing or what it was, but I mean, it was trench warfare at that point. So there was also, you know, trenches everywhere. So there were, you know, French soldiers there as well. And also probably British Expeditionary Forces, whoever, you know, Americans too, but I'm sure they had them all kept together as one unit because they weren't going to integrate other units with that. And they didn't want, I think at that point, because of this war college study, American commanders or Allied commanders probably had this misconception that they were unreliable or wouldn't perform as well as white soldiers. So they were just like, oh, you French people, you want some soldiers? Here's some soldiers.
And well, then they just went above and beyond.
Not only was it the first American unit to receive that Valor Award, there was a guy, his name was Private Henry Johnson. And because of this, he earned the nickname the Black Death, as a sign of respect for his prowess in combat. So during a, he was assigned to called Outpost 20. It was on the edges of the Argonne Forest in the Champagne region of France. And they had equipped them, of course, with French rifles, French helmets, French equipment, everything. So he was on observation post duty on May 14th in 1918. And they came under attack by a large German raiding party, could have numbered up to 36 German soldiers. Using his ammunition, grenades, after he ran out of those, the butt of his rifle, a bolo knife, and his fists, he repelled all of the Germans, killed four while wounding others, rescued this guy from capture, and then saved the lives of his fellow soldiers. He suffered 21 wounds during the ordeal. And that actually got him the individual citation as well for that Croix de Guerre.
Wow.
Himself. So there was no, and that unit itself being on the front lines, of course, for that entire time, there was no, you know, shortage of examples of these guys fighting with distinction. So the war college stuff was full of shit. But in 1940, the army still had segregationist policies, unfortunately. So April 39, FDR signed an order mandating the expansion of the civilian pilot training program. And that's kind of where we get Tuskegee gets his shot and starts being able to train pilots. They had such a solid training program, and they had kind of the belief that not only did they have to be as good as, you know, white training programs and the white pilots, is that because there was so much pressure and scrutiny on them that they actually had a higher bar that they set for themselves.
Yeah.
So where they would wash out pilots out of this program that would have, had they been white with the same skill set, been passed through other white training programs.
This wasn't like the bottom of the list. These were people that would have been the top of the list had happenstance been a different color.
Exactly. But they had a chip on their shoulder automatically in that situation, to where they were having to then prove themselves beyond a shadow of a doubt that they were capable of doing this kind of stuff. The training program was actually headed by this guy named Charles Alfred Anderson. And Charles Alfred Anderson was he was black, and he could not get into, prior to the whole civilian training program, he learned how to fly before that. He learned how to fly by purchasing a plane and teaching himself how to fly.
What?
Yes. He bought a plane before he knew how to fucking fly it. And taught himself how to fly so well, in fact, that he was put in charge of the training program for Tuskegee.
How do you teach yourself how to land? How is that a thing? Nowadays, you have simulators and shit like that to where
there's no fucking you're in the YouTube air. To even give you. There's no one on the controls being like, have you ever landed a plane before? We're going to walk you through this. No, he had to. He said he fell in love of course, he's not still alive or anything like that, but he's known as the father of black aviation. He was so good that during the training program, when he was training these black pilots, Eleanor Roosevelt came down to take a look at the program and wanted to go up with him. And he took her up, took her on an air tour and everything like that. And she was just fucking grinning ear to ear. She was talking to the ground crews and everything like that. There's pictures of this online. I don't know if it's a rumor, just kind of speculation, but part of that also leads to possibly her going back to FDR and being like, these guys are the real deal. You need to fucking put some pressure and let these guys, you know, start combat training. So
what do you think the white soldiers thought about that?
They
were a little angry that the first lady was willing to go up with that.
The only real white soldiers around this area were white officers in command of this.
But they had to have heard it. It had to have come through the grapevine of the army saying.
Yeah, and I mean, at the same time, I don't know if it's like the consensus between all of, you know, the black soldiers and the black pilots and kind of everyone that took part in this was that the program, being the experiment, was designed to fail. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you did have people that would go, even if they had segregationist policies, they realized that if these guys did end up going to war, that they needed to be competently trained.
Oh yeah.
And so some people would, you know, you would see them being racist in other ways, but when it came to training them, it would look bad on them. Like, I don't know if they could just pass it off and be like, see, they're inferior or anything like that. But then what if that guy in charge of that group that was training the other guy in charge of another wasn't a racist and was training them to the best of his abilities and they were successful? Then it would look bad. Either everyone had to fail or no one had to fail, I think, in that scenario, or would look bad on the commanding officers.
Well, when they're in the air, it doesn't really matter what color they are, because if you die because somebody wasn't properly protecting you mm-hmm. in the air, you're dead at that point. So
your commanding officer takes the heat for all of that stuff. Yeah. That's who's in charge of making sure everyone's doing their jobs. And it got into, you know, there were certain circumstances where, you know, white commanders or, you know, people in charge would wash out pilots out of the Tuskegee program just for minor shit. Like, they would invent shit. Someone brushed up against me. Someone was fighting against the MPs or something like that.
It was changing lanes without signaling.
Exactly. Usually when white pilots would graduate, you know, their military training and everything like that, they would be deployed within a month. Or a month was kind of the average. Black pilots, the first graduating class, it took 14 months for them to be deployed. Because you had, basically you were sending these, you know, squadrons to white commanding officers in other parts of the world, in other theaters of war, in Europe or Italy or North Africa. Well, they're not seeing this training. And if they have these dogmatic beliefs that, you know, black people are inferior and can't do this, they're not going to request or want to accept those squadrons mm-hmm. or those groups of pilots. So that's why it took so long. And there was also some pressure by a guy named Noel Parrish. He was a colonel. He basically set up conditions for the Tuskegee pilots to succeed to the best of their abilities. He was an ally in this situation. He recognized that this could be, you know, they could be great pilots. They could be useful in warfare just like anybody else could.
Wasn't an experiment for him.
No. He saw what their potential was, and he was going to do what he could to do it. So much so, in fact, that he actually, I'm trying to see who he went in front of, because they weren't getting deployed. He ends up going up the chain to, like, the lieutenant secretary of war or something like that, and is like, you need to fucking give these guys a job because they can do it. Because this 14 months, they're not just sitting on their thumbs. They're fucking training, too. Yeah. They're continuing to train.
They're getting sharper. They're getting better. They're not just milling about waiting. They're continuing their craft.
So the first class of the Tuskegee Airmen formed what they called the 99th Pursuit Squadron. Basically, it was a fighter squadron, but they didn't call it a fighter squadron at the time. They called it a pursuit squadron. And finally, on April 43, they were deployed to North Africa after, like I was saying, Parrish. He went to the Defense Secretary Leavitt and was like, you got to fucking get these guys into combat. We're already, you know, pilots are already short. We're stretched across all these theaters of war. Give these guys a chance. So Colonel Benjamin O'Davis Jr., the son of the first at that point, he was also a West Point graduate. He was given essentially command of that squadron. So they were sent to North Africa. When they got there, they trained with different planes when they were there. They were given hand-me-down equipment, kind of second-tier type stuff for training. And then when they got there, they were also kind of given hand-me-down aircraft. The first aircraft that they flew, I believe it was going to be the P-40s, and I'm going to make references to some movies and everything so people can kind of know what they're like. So the P-40s in the Pearl Harbor movie, the two planes that Ben Affleck and Josh Hartnett fly up in, those are P-40s. So it was a good aircraft when it was, you know, created, but it wasn't on par with any of the German aircraft. The only thing that it could do is it could outturn German aircraft. It couldn't climb as fast as them. It didn't have a faster, you know, just speed. It couldn't dive as quickly as them. I'm not sure about the armaments. I think throughout the war, the German planes had better armaments. But so they were given these planes and they were basically tasked with do what you can with this kind of stuff and hope that you can be successful.
Make chicken salad out of chicken shit.
Pretty much. So there came at some point when I'm not sure exactly how far into the campaign they were at, but this guy, Lieutenant Charles B. Hall, he was the first black pilot to shoot down an enemy in World War II, to take down a German airplane. And at some point after the unit had been in combat for a while, this guy named Colonel Mo Meyer, he basically tried to slander the record of the 99th based upon their combat record. I don't know if he strictly pointed out that it was due to their lack of enemy kills or anything like that, but when you're a squadron, like a fighter squadron, I think your success is measured how many air victories you have. Well, the whole point is these guys weren't assigned to any situation where they could have a chance at air combat. Basically, if they got into situations where there was air combat, it was on the way to or coming back from the situations that they were assigned what they call close air support. They were basically going after railway cars, infrastructure, that kind of stuff. So dive bombing, strafing ground targets. They weren't getting into a lot of situations, but if there was ever, you know, German or enemy air cover, they would have a chance to engage. And I think that's where Charles B. Hall was able to go ahead and claim his first victory. So he's kind of muddying their results of saying, like, well, see, they're not effective. We were right about it this entire time. Well, it just so happened that good old Benjamin O. Davis Jr. had actually returned stateside because he was going to be taking command of the entire black fighter squadrons or black program. And it was the 332nd squadron or 332nd airborne group. So he had come back to take over overall command of that. Before, he had just been in command of just the 99th. And then he's coming back. Well, at that same time, he gets called to the Pentagon to basically be grilled by Mo Meyer. And during this meeting, it was called the McCloy Committee. He just completely destroyed. He had his ducks in a fucking row and just destroyed all of Mo Meyer's arguments. He was like, okay, well, you want to talk about our combat record? Well, this is how many missions involving air combat we've been involved in. But if you want to go ahead and look at our record as far as strafing ground targets and bombings, they were exemplary at it. They were very good at it. So basically the McCloy Committee is like, okay, I guess this is horse shit, and didn't break them up, didn't pull them out of war or anything like that.
Well, and it just goes to show what you were talking about. There's levels of competency that white pilots had to have that were considered exemplary when they were good, but black pilots had to go above and beyond exemplary for a white pilot to try to justify, like, saying, hey, we're still doing the same shit. Mm-hmm. You're just giving us the jobs that you want to give us excelling at.
And although this was an entire, African-American run unit, that's just, they're not a standalone unit. They then report up the command and they have white commanders that are in charge of assigning them to what air squadrons or what groups and everything.
They're not in charge of where they're going, but they're, whatever they're being tasked with doing, they're doing it.
They're doing it to the best of their abilities and surpassing expectations. At some point, eventually, the 99th is reassigned to the 15th Air Force for bomber escort. This is where shit starts getting real for them and where they start really to shine. The 15th Air Force, they really lucked out in the sense that the commanders of the 15th viewed it as a meritocracy. It wasn't based upon what you look like or anything like that. It was based upon your results. And so when they assigned them to bomber escort, this is when they finally have the opportunity to engage the enemy. Because the only time that you would really engage fighters weren't, flying over targets to go ahead and attack them or bomb them in large amounts. What they were basically in charge of is fighters would go up to try to take out the bombers before they reached their targets. So you would have squadrons, the 99th, would go up and they would provide bomber escort. So you would just fly with the bombers and basically keep them safe. And if fighters came in, you would chase off the fighters or try to shoot them down.
Their whole main goal is to get the payload to where the drop zone is.
Exactly, and then come back alive. So eventually four black fighter squadrons, I didn't write down the names of all of them. The 99th was part of it. They combined to form the 332nd Air Group. Benjamin O. Davis Jr. had a strict rule, and it was stay with the bombers. That was their mission. That was what they were going to do. Now, that sounds like common sense if you're providing air support for the bombers and a bomber escort.
Yeah.
Well, that wasn't the case, because what would happen with these other, like, white, predominantly white, or at this point it was all white, the ones that were outside of the 332nd, they would spot fighters and the fighter planes would take off away from the bombers, leaving them exposed, chasing kills, chasing glory, chasing their own personal accolades.
Yeah, chasing glory.
Exactly. this left essentially, like if you had essentially a huge squadron and these bombers would fly in large groups, you have your air cover that's providing, all of a sudden they see a group of Germans coming in, they go to chase them off. Well, what's not to say that there's another German fighter squadron coming in from another direction that then leaves you completely susceptible? And I mean, the bombers weren't defenseless, but you would have, it was mostly B-17s, which had a crew of 10, and then B-25s, which had a crew of 4 to 6. So each of these bombers, it's not like a single seat fighter where if you lose a fighter, you're losing one guy.
Yeah.
You could lose 10 people if one of these B-17s go down.
Mass casualties.
Exactly. So their goal was to get these pilots and get these bombers to their targets and get them home safely. They were so successful at it that they started to become known as the Red Tail Angels.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Prior to this, and I want to say they didn't do it with the P-40s that they got before. They then got P-47s, what are called Thunderbolts, a more reliable aircraft, a newer aircraft. They started painting the tails red as their, you know, their sign. And they became so good and reliable at protecting these bombers that eventually bomber groups and bomber command would start requesting, and the pilots would be like, we want the red tails. They didn't even know that they were black. They just knew that their success record, that they knew they were much more likely to get home if they had these guarding them.
Yeah, the myth of the red tails is what preceded them. Like, had they shown up and they'd seen these red-tailed P-47s or whatever they were, and then they see the pilots get out, and they're like, oh, shit. You guys are black?
They're at different bases, so the bombers and fighters would never land at the same base, and that's why they didn't know. That's why also they would start requesting them, not knowing that essentially they were black. That had no bearing on it. They would just say, hey, we just went through this mission with the Red Tails, and we lost little to no bombers. So we're going to keep requesting these guys to keep us safe. So it was strictly off their performance that they were getting these requests to try to, you know, cover these specific units. Eventually toward, I think, I want to say it was in 44, they finally got what would be the Cadillac of American air fighters. And it was the P-51 Mustang. The P-51 Mustang was essentially the most advanced aircraft the United States at that point had invented. And there were some different variants of it. If anyone has ever seen the movie Red Tails, that's more of an example of the P-51D that they got. There's the P-51 is probably the most well-known American fighter plane. It's the one that's usually all stainless steel with the markings on it. And then it has like the bubble canopy. The P-51D didn't have the bubble canopy. It kind of had a more traditional canopy where it almost looked like there was a headrest and then the canopy kind of slid over it.
Okay, so it doesn't set down on it. It slides over.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as the armaments went, it was like 6 50-cal machine guns, 3-inch wing. I think they were Rolls-Royce, like, powered engines. Basically, they could keep up and take on any German fighter.
The Rolls-Royce of the air.
Yeah, so when they got these, it was fucking game on. And the back home, it wasn't just fighter groups that were being trained as part of the Tuskegee group or program. They started training a bombardment group called the 447th. And they were going to be, I think, deployed over in the Pacific Theater of War. But there was this guy named Colonel Selway who was a fucking douchebag. And regardless of any segregationist policies or anti-segregationist policies, he still kind of enforced them in a way and pretty much prevented these guys from ever being able to participate in the war. Despite, you know,
Jim Crow style.
Exactly. And I mean, Jim Crow was still, those laws were still in effect in a lot of these states, especially Alabama.
Oh, yeah.
So when the Tuskegee program was also kind of getting up and running, they basically had this thing called the Double V campaign. And the Double V campaign was for victory in the war, but then it also applied to victory over segregation, racism, stuff like that. They were hoping that the way that they performed and the way that they served their country with distinction would essentially, you know, you can't have the expectation it's going to completely wipe it out, but it would at least show people like, yeah, all of your preconceived notions are complete horseshit. You're going to need to reshape the way that you're thinking. Unfortunately, that's not, they won victory in Europe, but unfortunately the V for victory at home really wasn't there when they ended up showing back up at home. There was some other stuff going on at home, and the 447th was part of this. there was a thing called the Freeman Field Mutiny, and whoever was in charge of the area where the Tuskegee programs were, there was a rule about having, if they were going to have officers clubs, you had to allow all the officers in. Now, if you're a pilot, you're an officer. Yeah. I think you could either be a first lieutenant, second lieutenant, or a captain, but by being a pilot, you're automatically an officer. You would also could be an officer if you were essentially like a ground chief, or you were in charge of like the ground crews or maintenance. Well, they weren't being allowed into like white officers clubs. And in some situations, they would be like, okay, well, we're just going to create you a separate but equal officers club that you guys could use. Well, what they did at that point is they made one officers club the whites only officer club. They made the other officer club the trainee officer club. And then that was also for like white people only as well. So they were still trying to keep them separate despite them having similar or even some situations the same rank. And yeah, that whole segregation thing, it was contradictory to what the War Department had put out their policies about integration. Actually, the trainee club was considered, that's the one that they allowed to be the black one, but they were calling them trainees. They weren't respecting the fact that they were officers.
Yeah, all the effort and everything that they put in order to get that officer title was being undermined, even so simply as to not be able to call them officers anymore. They still had to be called trainees. Like, everything that they went through in order to get that is still, well, you're just a trainee.
Mm-hmm. Well, at one point, 101 of the Tuskegee Airmen that were still, you know, stationed around that area, they started trying to go into the officers club because that was their right. Were officers. Yeah. There wasn't supposed to be any segregation there. Well, three of them were jailed for noncompliance, brushing into somebody, trumped up fucking charges, all that kind of shit. I think a ton of them were required to sign basically a reprimand, acknowledging essentially that they had been in the wrong and everything like that. Some of them ended up signing it, of course, under pressure. Some of them didn't end up signing it. Two of the guys that were jailed actually signed the reprimand. This guy named Roger Cherry, he didn't, and he was court-martialed. Now, if you're court-martialed for something like this, it can carry up to being shot by a firing squad. He fully knew that.
He took his life into his hands by making that choice.
They kicked him out. He then went to law school, but because of being court-martialed, he couldn't take the bar. So he couldn't even put himself into a position to then come back to try to defend himself because of this shit. Eventually, years later, the records were eventually expunged. But this was, I think it gets lost here that the Tuskegee Airmen and the Tuskegee program was one of the first examples, essentially, of a peaceful protest against inequality, because they weren't violent about this. They were just trying to have the same rights that other officers did serving in the army
that they had earned
and that were supposed to be provided to them based upon the, you know, policies of the War Department about integration. It was just, you would get these fucking assholes that were in command of these specific areas that would take it upon themselves if they didn't like something to try to work around the rules.
They weren't trying to go above and beyond what they were already promised. They were just trying to get what they were promised.
Exactly. So that's a huge thing that comes out of this, is that not only were they fighting a war overseas for this country that then back home was still trying to fuck them over, and they were still overseas trying to do this better than everybody else.
Well, and that's the whole, like we were talking about in the beginning, this wasn't for any sort of personal valor. Like, none of this was trying to...
I think part of it was, but it's no different. The reasons that they... either enlisted. So the enlisted guys would essentially be like your ground crews and those types of people. The people that either went through the air program or, you know, West Point, all that kind of stuff, those would be your officers. But they, you know, there didn't have to be a difference of why they were doing what they wanted to do. Like, yeah, white pilots were chasing valor and glory and all that kind of stuff. Pride of country. There shouldn't be any difference why black pilots couldn't do the same thing. Yeah, maybe they wanted to go over there and make a name for themselves. That's no different than any other white pilot, but they had to do it better.
Well, and they had to do it while knowing that any failure on their end wasn't just going to reflect on them. It was going to reflect on everybody that was the same skin color as them.
So exactly. Any step out of line would reflect poorly. Any type of disobedience or any type of trumped up shit could be taken as a sign that, see, they can't do this. They can't do this as well as white pilots.
Any failure on their end was going to go into those bullshit reports saying, see, this is why we can't trust them, which is such a wild concept to think that you're doing it for yourself. But you're also doing it to try to bring up everybody around you that is the same race. When, in all reality, it plays no part in anything. It doesn't matter what color you are when you're up in the air flying. All that matters is your trainings and your abilities.
Mm-hmm. This guy named Lieutenant Colonel Herb Carter, I don't know what point he said this. I don't know if it was, you know, well after, you know, the Tuskegee program had been successful. But he had a saying that excellence is the antidote to racism. And I think it's no more prominent than with the Tuskegee Airmen. It's what their sole mission was, is to show that we could do this, but guess what? We're going to do it better. So overall, 992 pilots were trained at Tuskegee during World War II. Here's the thing that impresses me most, and here's where it boils down to the number, and here's what you can't fucking argue with, is they ran, I want to say, 312 missions. The Tuskegee Airmen throughout the course of World War II ran 312 missions. Now, that's a combination of both the close air support for the ground type stuff, but 179 of those missions were bomber escort. They lost 27 bombers over the course of 179 missions. Now, that's not to say that when they give that number is 27 bombers lost to enemy fighters. Now, not every bomber mission had enemy fighters that came after them. They would lose airplanes sometimes to flak, to ground artillery and stuff like that. But a fighter camp, you know, a fighter plane is just as likely to get hit by flak as a bomber is. I mean, they're smaller, so maybe not as likely, but they were still in that position. And that's not something that they were in any control of. They weren't going down there to try to strafe, you know, ground targets or anything. They were to stay with the bombers.
No, and I could be wrong in saying this, but not every bomber mission was a sole bomber going up there. There could have been three or four bombers. So losing one out of three.
These groups of bombers could sometimes be hundreds of bombers taken off from different. Basically what they had is they never really had. So you would have fighter air bases and those were kind of scattered around because you wouldn't have big ones because it would make you a large target and make you easier to hit. Same thing with bombers. Mm-hmm. You would maybe have an airfield somewhere, you know, in North Africa, in Italy. That's where they were doing their predominantly where they were doing their thing early in the war was North Africa. And then as we pushed the Germans out of North Africa, we kept getting closer. We moved into Italy and everything. So, yeah, not every mission had a ton of bombers, but they're not going to send up bombers three or four at a time. These are groups, huge groups, probably close, you know, sometimes maybe 50 to 100 bombers in these groups. So you'd have multiple air groups of the 99th and the other four groups that were covering these guys.
So to even say that was one bombing campaign that went through, one bombing mission, to lose 27 of potentially 50 bombers that were still going up, that was still a successful...
Not 27 per mission.
I know, but that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Even if it was just one sole mission, if they lost 27 bombers out of the 50 that went up, there were still 23 other...
Yeah, but that would have been considered a loss for them to allow 27 bombers, because it wasn't like, you know, a fighter could take down a bomber, but, you know... Bombers aren't defenseless. They essentially, like the B-17 that had the crew of 10, basically you had your two pilots. You then had like a bombardier that was a navigator. You had guys running that. Then you had about five guys running turrets mm-hmm. in the plane. So the bombers were able to kind of fight off planes and everything like that. But it's like, you know, stirring up a hornet's nest. You're sitting there in a slower moving bomber and you have enemy strafing you or trying to shoot you from other directions. Not every gun could aim at a plane at the same time. So, I mean... Yeah, they were kind of defensible, but having fighters there was the ultimate deterrent, especially if they were good.
Well, yeah, and in total, with the amount of bombers that they escorted up, losing 27 had to have been less than 1% of the amount of bombers that they protected over other missions.
Definitely.
Way less.
Definitely. And out of the other 15th group, the 15th Air Force, there was other squadrons of all white pilots. Their average losses were 46.
So...
Almost half of the losses that these white squadrons would have. Because again, part of their thing was red tails, stay with the fucking bombers. These other guys are off chasing glory and all this kind of shit.
Don't go chase butterflies out in left field. Your main goal is to protect these bombers.
So overall, the red tails had 112 aerial victories, kills by 72 different pilots. Four of their pilots were one short of A status, and A status is having five kills. There's some debate about this, though, because there's a circumstance where you're going to like the name that they named these two guys. There were two guys, and let me find their names real quick. Oh, where are these? Ah, there they are. So two guys, Captain Wendell Pruitt and Lieutenant Colonel Lee Archer were known as the Gruesome Twosome.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So these guys were, I would assume the Lieutenant Colonel is probably the higher rank. So I believe Pruitt was either his wingman or it was vice versa. I can't remember who was his support guy. Yeah. So basically the job when you're in a fighter group like that is you would have your lead pilot and he would have your wingman. Wingman's job is just to protect your tail. The wingman is the guy that is, I don't even think this is debatable, so I'm just going to say he was their first ace. He had two kills at this point, and they were coming back from a bomber escort mission. The bombers, they had got to the point where the bombers had broken off, were in a safe area, and they could go down and land at their bases. So the fighters were all heading back to their base. They're flying over this giant lake in Italy. And as they're flying straight ahead, they notice across the lake flying toward them is an entire group close to equal size of German fighters. And they were coming back from a mission, so they're coming back on the tail end of their fuel. They're like, go right at them. They go to engage them. And during this fight, they get into a position, the Gruesome Twosome gets into two positions where they're not flying super close to each other. They would fly far enough back, maybe 1,000 feet, to where if a German spotted the lead plane and went in behind them, they didn't really notice the plane that was tailing them behind as the wingman. So what would end up happening is whoever the lead pilot was, he would spot airplane or a German fighter, and he's like, I'm going after him. So he would go after, and they would start, you know, maneuvering to try to get a shot at him. You would then sometimes get a German pilot that came in behind him to try to help out the other German pilot he was getting shot at. Yeah. The wingman is right behind getting shots at that other German. So you almost have German-American. So during this time, the wingman actually takes out one of the guys on his tail. The lead pilot takes out the guy in front of him. They go and find another set. Lead pilot zeroes in on another Messerschmitt or whatever it was, German plane. Another German plane comes in behind him to try to get him off of him. Wingman comes in again and just...
They're just leapfrogging these motherfuckers.
Yep, and ends up taking out the guy tailing him. His lead pilot then takes off another one. Well, you weren't supposed to leave your lead pilot.
Yeah.
He sees another plane, and he's like, I'm going after that guy. So I want to say it was Archer, actually. He peels off. He's like, I know this guy's going to be pissed and everything. Peels off, chases this guy down. And I want to say he chased him, and the guy was making a run back for his airbase. And I want to say he gets close to the airbase, and it was after bombers had bombed that airbase or something like that. So there was a bunch of smoke and everything. Yeah. He's chasing him through this fucking smoke and everything over the airbase. He's getting shot at from the ground guns and everything, ends up taking out this pilot again, and then just fucking bugs out. So he got his fifth kill and became the first ace.
Dude, why isn't this Top Gun? Why is that not?
There's two movies that have been made about this. One HBO did a while back that had Lawrence Fishburne, and I want to say it was called The Tuskegee Airmen.
Yeah.
And then they made another one just here, not recent. I think fucking 10 years ago was recent. But it's called Red Tails. And
T. Perry.
Yeah, I don't have a gripe against this movie because it's a good movie, but and I mean, it really paints them in the light that they should be shown. This is a story that everyone needs to know about. But compared to series like Band of Brothers or The Pacific, or there's a new one coming out by Tom Cruise and Steven Spielberg, the other two called Bomber Boys, and it's about bomber squadrons over Europe during World War II. I feel like they could have done a better job with this movie by making it a series about these guys, following these guys all the way through Tuskegee training and all that kind of stuff. But the movie does a good job about showing how good these guys really were and how dedicated they were to protecting these bombers.
Sort of like a Pearl Harbor type where they made a movie, but they could have made it better. It was still good. Yeah,
they might have thrown in a couple love stories or something like that, or you had to get some entertainment factor with stuff on the ground. It was a situation where, a lot of the actors were good. They had Cuba Gooding Jr. and some other good actors in, but then they were throwing in, you know, people that were popular at the time, like fucking Neo.
They made a movie for the masses instead of the real.
Yeah, it had like a young Michael B. Jordan in it and everything. And
he's a hot guy. I mean, you gotta have some lookers in there.
Yeah.
You gotta bring the female audience in.
That's the thing. And I mean, of course these pilots are gonna have swagger and everything like that, but I almost feel like they kind of bumped it up and it kind of lost some of the seriousness of what I think these guys were going through and how I think these guys behaved. But at the same time, I wasn't there, so I don't fucking know. So maybe the movie's an accurate representation. Could. I think my biggest gripe on it is don't boil this down to a 2.5 hour movie about these guys. Give them their due. Give them the series that they need. Explain their entire struggle, because although it does kind of touch on that kind of stuff, it kind of fast forwards them into the war, and you get to see them, you know, doing what they're doing, building their reputation, protecting these bombers, building the reputation of, you know, never, they had a reputation for the longest time of never losing a bomber. And that reputation wasn't even really propagated by them. They were just so good at predicting
everything though.
Yes. I think at one point they might've gone a long, long series of missions without losing a single bomber. And I think that's maybe where it got propagated, is they went an extensive period of time without losing one. But still, even over the course of 179 missions, you only lose 27 bombers to enemy aircraft. That's fucking incredible. Half of what the average was of other white squadrons.
That's excellent. That's a, it's something that we haven't really talked about. I'm sure we have the understanding. But, and maybe HBO had a little bit of a head start on this because they did Band of Brothers, right?
Yeah, and the Tuskegee Airmen, that was done before Band of Brothers. And out of the two movies, I feel like that one's a better representation of what they're going through. Of course, it's not as flashy, or, you know, it doesn't have the computer-generated shit that the new movie has, so it's not as, like, visually appealing. But I think it does a better job of really enforcing the seriousness of it.
Well, and some things are just, there's movies that are just destined to be movies. But there's stories that are told that movies will never do justice to.
Exactly. You can't focus on, you know, the characters that should be focused on. You're focusing on the leading men, or you're focusing on the character that maybe had the most interesting storyline or something like that. Maybe not the one that was the best at what they were doing.
I think there is hope, too, because it seems like in a certain way movies are maybe dying off to series. You hear people talk about binging a series more than you talk or hear people talking
people
about
going to a movie. People want details. People want to, like, you watch a 2.5 hour movie and, like, how invested can you get in that? How much of an emotional impact can you, how much can you know the characters and know their stories? Like, I watch Band of Brothers once a year. I make it a point to watch that every year. And every time I feel like I focus on someone different and their story.
Yeah.
And it's like watching a completely different series about what that person's experience was going through that. And again, that's just you watching something. I don't even know, like what is that? Like, you're flying 25,000 feet with 50 bombers around you, and you're just sitting there looking around. And you see enemy air, and then you're literally just dogfighting through the skies. Not only are you doing that, but then you're trying not to hit the other planes while you're flying through them and everything. It's just, it's a weird, you were describing something about when we were texting about you watching wrestling.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that you were watching, like, legendary matches with, like, the superstars, the well-known wrestlers. You were watching the guys that were masters of their craft that could wrestle for half an hour, nailing every move without ever making a mistake. And I feel like that's what these guys were. They weren't, you know, the most well-known, obviously not the most well-known fighter groups, because I think a lot of that was probably people known over, you know, Britain or over the skies of Europe where they were getting more action. But, you know, proof is in the pudding when it comes down to this stuff. The numbers don't lie.
Yeah.
They also, the 99th or the 332nd, hold the record for the longest escort mission of the war, escorting an entire bomber group to Berlin. Now, from
From where?
Let's see.
Because Berlin's in the thick of it. That is the,
I mean, Berlin's like central Germany, but not only is it central Germany, that's not to say how much of the area outside of Germany was still under occupied hands and everything like
you're
that.
You're not just going to the epicenter. You're fighting the whole fucking way there and the whole way back. There's no, like, you're not just going to a destination. The whole entire journey is going to be not a dogfight the whole way, but you have to have your eyes up the entire time.
Yeah, you have to be on top of your game the entire time, looking to make sure that you're not getting jumped early. And it's not just that, like, it would be, if you're flying over an occupied territory, remember what I was saying about having all of these, like, smaller airfields spaced everywhere? It's not like they're just launching German fighters from one location. They're constantly can be harassed the entire time that they're flying. And so let me see.
You're getting ground fire. You're getting everything from all those little bases the whole way. You're not having to ramp up to get there and then ramp down to come back. You have to be ramped the whole way there because you don't know what you're going to encounter. Is there a drop in intelligence to know that, hey, this airfield that's off here is actually going to be one of the protectors as opposed to somebody that you're just going to be able to fly over. Like, you have to spot every single one of those airfields down there because every one of them is a potential threat.
Exactly. So let's see where that is. Sorry, I don't have that information pulled up, but I think I have it. Oh, come on.
Just out of left field.
If it's the longest, there were some long fucking missions because you would have planes launching from the north of England to go all the way across and into Germany to bomb Berlin during their bombing campaigns.
So you're crossing countries.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, and I think at this point they might have been launching out of Italy. I would assume that it was probably somewhere because I don't think they went any further into like Germany. I think Italy is probably the closest that they were stationed. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you've seen pictures of it, but you'll sometimes see fighters and they look like they almost look like they're carrying bombs, but they're carrying these like their actual fuel tanks under their wings.
Yeah.
And so for these long range bomber missions, these P-51s would have these fuel tanks underneath their wings. Well, when you're flying, you're going to use your reserve fuel first. That kind of sounds counterproductive, but the reason that they would do that is you would want to use that fuel first because if you ever got into a situation where you were dogfighting, you know, these airplanes, they're single propeller airplanes, they're balanced to fight in a certain way. If you're going to get into a dogfight, you had to drop your tanks. And so you would want to use that fuel up as much as you could first. And then if you had to drop them, you still had all of your fuel that was being held within the aircraft.
Well, and having the ability to drop them means that they're targets in a dogfight. Because if you can shoot a fuel tank that's on the outside, you're going to get a big blow up. So if you can drop the area that's going to be the most flammable.
You're not only dropping a vulnerability structurally, but you're also then making your airplane lighter and more maneuverable to fight against these guys.
Yeah, so it sounds odd to use your reserve first, but it's actually very smart because it gives them less of a target to hit and it gives you more maneuverability once you shed those.
Exactly. So what ended up happening during this mission though is their job was to support these bombers for a while, but then they were supposed to be relieved by another fighter squadron that was in closer that could then take off with more fuel, relieve them. That squadron never showed up. And instead of saying, well, we might not be equipped for this situation, the Red Tails were like, we're taking you guys all the way and we're bringing you home.
They have no choice. That's their glory to do that. They can't just peel off because the others didn't show up.
I mean, technically they could because they would be pushing the limits of their fuel. They were risking in a situation like that, that not only was their job to escort them to a certain place. Think of it this way. Your job is to escort them, let's say, halfway, three quarters of the way, whatnot. If the closer you get, the more German resistance they're going to be, the more dangerous it's going to be. Not only that, what if you have to end up dropping your fuel tanks a little early and then you don't have enough fuel to get back? You're taking that risk. You're taking the risk of being shot down over heavily occupied territory and not just moderately occupied territory. The risk for these guys, it's not just like, oh, hey, we're just going to take you a little bit further. It's like there's substantial risk in doing this, but stay with the bombers. And these guys had such respect for their role and just integrity that they stayed with it and ended up being the longest escort mission of World War II. They also had a situation toward the end of the war, the Germans actually developed a jet fighter.
Uh-huh.
It was pretty close. I think it was in 45 that it was developed. They say if it would have been developed any sooner than it could have, maybe if it was a year or two sooner, it could have potentially changed the course of the war. But there was a situation in which they were doing bomber escort and a squadron of the jet fighters came in after the bombers. And these guys are in prop-driven planes, not as fast or anything, and don't have as heavy of armaments. If you have a jet fighter too, you're able to put, and this might sound kind of unimportant, but okay, so you're flying a plane, you have three guns in each wing. Your guns are sighted to essentially meet at a certain point coming off your wings, depending on if that's 1,000 feet out or what that is. It's a little bit harder to aim like that, knowing where the distance is. These German jets, they would have their guns positioned in the nose where they're firing straight down the nose of their plane and able to go ahead and aim a little bit better. So it's easier to fire like that. A lot of the German fighters were like that too, where they were able to time the shots between the propellers, which I have no fucking clue how that would even work.
That makes no sense to me.
No, I don't. But somehow the guns were okay. So they end up shooting down during this one engagement, three of these jet fighters.
In planes? Yeah, because we didn't have jets.
No. In their P-51s, they take down three of these German jet fighters. They weren't the first group to take down German jet fighters because I think that they were probably a little more prevalent closer to Berlin and that theater, especially like with all the Allies pushing in, the majority of them pushing in from France and everything. But yeah, to go against a technologically superior...
An alien force, basically.
Yes, aside from the V-2 rockets and things like that, there weren't really a lot of jet fighters out there. It was the first time they'd really ever seen them. And here they are like, fuck it, let's do it.
Yeah, they're either going to take us down or we're going to take them down. It doesn't matter what they have. We just have to figure out.
We're not running.
Yeah, we have to make what we have work.
So they had three confirmed victories against Messerschmitt, like B-10 something. I can't remember what it was, but three victories against those guys. And I mean, as far as their accolades and everything like that, they definitely proved themselves to be compared to the other groups and everything. I'm not saying everybody else outside of the 15th fighter group had that average of, 46 losses compared to their 27, but that was lower, if not as low as almost every other fighter support group.
They were the echelon of the best of the best.
And it, just their reputation for never leaving the bombers. How many lives, you're saving the lives of 10 guys per plane. To know the importance of that, to know that it's not just about you, to have that type of discipline and control. I mean, Benjamin O. Davis Jr. told them that the rule was, he's like, if you guys leave the bombers, I don't care if you take out 10 planes single-handedly. The moment you land, you're out. I don't care how impressive that you are, the reason that you left, you do not leave these bombers. They would leave the bombers if they absolutely had to chase them off if they were being attacked. But for the most part, they stayed with these guys the entire time. That's a discipline that not a lot of other air groups can claim that they had.
No, the goal was the goal, and they strove to just keep the goal in sight. They weren't going out, because I'm sure being an ace, I think is what you call them.
Yeah, if you get five kills, you're considered an ace.
That's a goal in and of yourself. That's a personal achievement and victory.
That's a huge feather in your cap. That's bronze star, silver star type stuff.
And you're not getting that for just doing your job. You're getting that for doing something else. So doing your job, you're not going to get the same kind of glory, but at the same time, if you can do your job the whole entire time and do what's asked of you, it's almost more, I guess, exciting to do your job so well as opposed to chase a personal accolade.
Yeah, exactly. And, going back to a theme within this podcast is, I wish I could say they came back home to, heroes welcomes and everything. And within their communities, yes, they were definitely heroes.
Absolutely.
Not only in their communities, but within the Black community as a whole, these guys were rock stars. We're all stars, giving, putting their lives on the line constantly to try to not only fight for a country that back home was still opposed to giving them equal rights, but to come home and be like, what else do we have to do? Like, what else do you want from us? They came home to still happen to be in different rooms. There was a guy that ended up, I don't know if he got wounded, but when he was on a train back home, they put him in a car, train car by himself. To segregate him from the white
core, basically. Yeah.
Or to keep him separated from the, from the white passengers or from the white soldiers. So victory in Europe, but unfortunately not immediate victory.
No.
When they came home. But a lot of these guys that ended up coming home went on to other roles. Some of them were, one of them, I think, was made another general at some point within the Air Force. Some of these guys got promoted. A lot of them continued the tradition of the Tuskegee Airmen by training other pilots, by continuing the program. They're getting a lot more recognition as of late. I want to say that when Bush Jr. was in office, he presented the Medal of Honor to somebody, or maybe as a citation for the entire group itself. But, I mean, we're looking at how many years since it happened before they really got the recognition. And how many of those guys, were still alive at that point. I mean, we still have some Tuskegee Airmen that are still alive. I would love to fucking talk to one. I've listened to a few interviews, and the way these guys talk about it, just overcoming all of the, these are people starting 10 steps behind and then ended up 10 steps ahead of, you know, a lot of their white counterparts.
Well, so much of this, I know that nowadays when you hear the word representation, it kind of leaves a sour taste in people's mouths, because representation, I think people get confused and they think like Hollywood representation and people on the big screen and in TV shows, they feel like that's a world-beating thing. Like, they feel like that's a culture. But representation outside of Hollywood and outside of major motion pictures and shit, representation is a very, very important thing, because like you say, with those pilots coming back to their communities and they're hailed as heroes inside of the black communities or Asian communities, Latin communities, anything like that, when you see those kind of successful pilots come back, that breeds in children's minds like, hey, that guy looks like me and that guy did that. Why can't I do that?
Mm-hmm.
It's huge. And I don't know as far as how the military breaks down racially now, but had they maybe given them more shine and more respect and treated them as equals, what would our military look like today? Would it be, I'm assuming it's probably pretty integrated at this point, like fully, but
yeah, but I mean, it's based upon a percentage of, you know, the population, everything. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not as, I don't know if there's an accurate representation within the military compared to the accurate representation of the populace.
Well, just like I talked about earlier, as far as, you know, when you go from slaves being the ones that do the menial housework to women doing the menial housework, I don't even know if it's still equal as far as that goes in the military, because for a very long time, women weren't allowed on the front lines.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully those barriers are being broken down too, but it's like, we can't just go from like segregation to everybody does the same job at the same time. There's steps that need to be taken along with racial lines and sexual mm-hmm. lines to get to that point. It's like, why? What's the worst part that's going to happen?
I mean, these guys shattered barriers, what they did. And it may not have had an immediate impact when they came home, but just a couple things that kind of happened, you know, after the fact. So after the war, Davis helped, he held other commands. He also helped plan the desegregation of the Air Force in 1948, commanded a fighter wing in the Korean War. He got promoted to a one-star general in 54, and then he became the first in 59, the first African-American officer to reach the rank of major general, which is a two-star general, and then was promoted to lieutenant general, three-star general in 65. And I mean, and that's just him. The unit itself got over 850 medals.
Damn.
Yeah. And they had two distinguished service medals and a silver star. And after in 1998, after Davis had retired and everything like that, he was honored by being awarded his fourth general star, making him the general of the highest order within the U.S. military.
He retired in 1998?
No, that was after. So He ended up retiring, and then he retired in 70. But then they circled back around. It's kind of like how they go back and they do the, what did they call it, the post?
Posthumous.
I never know how to fucking pronounce that. I hate that fucking word. But they kind of went back. And I believe he still received that while he was alive.
Good.
But, you know, yeah, if these guys were champions and, you know, whether it be purposely or inadvertently, they helped progress the civil rights movement. They shattered this preconceived notion that they were inferior and incapable of doing these jobs, you know, as good as, or, and in this situation, even better than a lot of their white counterparts. And so in that sense, these guys, you know, talking about it just like this doesn't do it justice.
No.
But
and we're only focusing on certain, you focused more on a group, whereas I focused on two just solo people.
Mm-hmm.
These aren't just like the only examples of this. There's examples of this everywhere. These are just the ones that
we couldn't take a day recording and cover everyone. Like you can, but at the same time, you know, it's nice to shine the light on people that, or groups of people that may not be as prevalent as others, you know, MLK, Malcolm X, people like that, that were, I guess in an age of media that were able to have more attention focused on them, you know, these guys were at a time when there wasn't a lot of, you know, interviews going on with them until after the war and then them sharing their stories. But I mean, it can't be understated, both between, you know, Hercules Posey, James Hennings, the Tuskegee Airmen, and everyone that participated in that, just the impact that they've had on not just the United States, but the world in general.
Well, I boil a lot of my understanding to things down to sports because it's just something that I can understand. And when you look at guys that were barrier breakers, well, Chamberlain wasn't the first black guy to play basketball,
mm-hmm.
but he was an icon. He was a guy that everybody got to see. Dominicans and just people in Latin and South America in baseball. What Fernando Valenzuela did on the mound changed Mexican culture towards baseball. It's no shock to know that baseball is predominantly Latin now because of all the stars of yesteryear that went back to their communities in these countries and developed baseball camps
mm-hmm.
that brought these guys up that are now major stars that walked so everybody else could run. It's huge.
And I mean, they ended up receiving two presidential during combat. They received two presidential citations for distinction in service. I mean, not enough can be said about what these people not only went through, but what they broke through and just did it to the highest ability.
Yeah, their starting line was a mile before everybody else's, but they still made it to the finish line.
Well, and I mean, in 1948, Truman enacted executive order. It's called 9981, and basically it was directing the equality of treatment of opportunity for all United States armed services. And at that time, it led to the end of racial segregation in the United States military forces. That would not have happened if these guys did not do what they did.
Yeah.
Show the example of what they can do.
And that's what they were. They were example to prove the rule, basically. They did their part in order to break ground. They broke through the glass ceiling that African Americans had in the military in order to open up the opportunities that there are today, mm-hmm. which I don't know as far as the military being separate from it and just not knowing a whole lot about it. It does make me feel good to hear a military member say something like, you know, I don't care what color you are. I don't care what gender you are. Mm-hmm. We're out there on the battlefield. You have to protect me and I have to protect you. That's a huge thing. And I hope that it is that way across every branch of the military. And the only way that I think we got to that point today is because of these gentlemen.
Yep. So I hope to a degree with these, you know, it's not three gentlemen, but these two individuals and then this, you know, extraordinary group of individuals and themselves. Just hope we did something somewhat justice by talking about this today. It's something that, you know, like we always say as two white guys, it's hard for us to wrap our hand around or to understand the struggle that these guys would have gone through when we haven't gone through anything. Not only the segregation, racism, discrimination, but to also be in wartime, you know, with essentially the highest stakes on the line. And to just do that at such a high level and with such distinction, it's truly amazing.
Yeah, these guys, you know, they die. But when you're dealing with minorities, if you die or you fail, it could have ripples and waves out towards.
Yeah, it's not just that you died serving, you know, your country, you know, heroically. It's like, what did you do wrong? Is that why you're dead? Did you do something wrong?
Yep. Yeah, it's a completely different lens that it gets looked at in.
All right, you got anything left?
No, I hope we did it justice. I hope that this kind of opens up the door for more people to look at it. And as far as these months go, Black History Month, Latin Heritage Month, whatever they call it, there's a reason why we need to have these things.
Yeah, definitely. And if, I mean, I know we've covered a lot of episodes at this point, everything. I think this one probably, if you're going to listen to anyone or recommend anything to your friends to of any of our episodes, I think this is definitely number one, if not within the top three for something that needs to be known.
Absolutely.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining us on this, and we'll see you next week.
Peace.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us for another episode. If you like what you heard, hit that subscribe and like button. Follow us. If you didn't like what you heard, still hit that anyway, because we'll probably cover something in the future that you do like. Please follow us on our social media. Adam, hit them with it.
Our Instagram is Historically High Pod, Historically High POD, and we are on Twitter at Historically High, that's Historically HI.
All right. And if you guys want to send in any feedback, suggestions, hit us up on those two, or you can even do it on Gmail. It's historicallyhighpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again.
Peace.